can you rely on America? That's one of the big questions that people have been asking throughout Donald Trump's time in office. And that question got an important new development this week. Iran wants nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia wants nuclear weapons. This week, Syria also took an important step towards getting nuclear weapons. And Tucker Carlson and Hunter Biden, two very different political figures. What can finally bring them together? We'll find out on today's Trumpet World. Can we trust America? It's a big question that American allies have been asking themselves for the last decade or more. We talked about America's rising debt last week. Can America even afford to keep protecting the rest of the world? It's paid a very steep price for doing that. But what does the world look like if America stops paying that burden? Well, this question had another important development this week, this time in Asia. And to get the latest on that, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, America's security alliance with South Korea. This has stood for 73 years now as a pillar in America's strategy to check Asian aggressors and to stabilize the Asian region. This alliance has been of immense strategic value to the United States. But in the last few years, some serious fissures have started to emerge in this pillar. And this week, they got quite a bit deeper. So just for a little bit of history here, the alliance dates back to the early 1950s during the Korean War. That's when America intervened and prevented South Korea from being conquered by North Korea. And the two nations established an alliance. And under its terms, the United States keeps more than 28,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. And it's hard to imagine a more strategically valuable place than this for America to have a very robust forward position. This is at a kind of a junction there between China, Japan, and Russia. And of course, it's immediately adjacent to North Korea. So that position is of great value to the United States military. Our presence there has augmented U.S. power in the Eastern Hemisphere and has just been foundational to decades of comparative peace in a region that has historically been just riven by conflict. And there's also the economic angle. This alliance has been economically very beneficial to the United States because our decision to keep South Korea from being swallowed up by North Korea and its backers in Moscow and Beijing, that decision has not just kept the South Korean people free, it has also let them flourish into a global economic powerhouse and a technological powerhouse. And it is a powerhouse that serves U.S. interests in a very direct way. America is, or South Korea rather, is America's seventh largest trade partner. And it's home to some cutting-edge companies, global leaders in semiconductors and batteries and vehicles and other advanced technology. South Korea also invests massively into the United States, building numerous factories here and strengthening American supply chains and helping the United States to reduce its dependence on Chinese technology as well, and creating thousands of American jobs. So the U.S.-South Korea alliance, it has helped to keep millions of South Koreans free, but it has also given America remarkable strategic and economic benefits. But President Trump appears to not see any of that. He doesn't seem to have that Reagan-esque kind of vision about supporting America's fellow democracies around the world, and he doesn't seem to see the immense strategic value and economic value that the alliance gives to America. He sees only the costs. Even in his first term, President Trump was saying that South Korea needed to quintuple how much it was paying to host U.S. troops. And then this time around, he's been extremely heavy-handed with tariffs on South Korea, putting tariff rates on them far higher even than those of some nations, many nations that are not U.S. allies at all. And he has kept on telling South Korea to be ready to fend for themselves militarily. And then on Sunday, President Trump said America would substantially reduce joint military exercises with South Korea due to the costs and due to President Trump's, quote, very good relationship with North Korean ruler Kim Jong-un. Now, this puzzled a lot of people in the United States and in South Korea, and those onlookers were puzzled even more when President Trump said that North Korea has been, quote, unthreatening and respectful during his time in office. This was just days after North Korea illegally launched some ballistic missiles and weeks after the North Korean ruler had pledged to, quote, exponentially expand his nation's illegal nuclear arsenal. And the statement also came amid North Korea's very extensive military support for Russia's war against Ukraine. And of course, while North Korea has been supporting Iran's military in numerous ways as well, particularly Iran's missile program. So a lot of onlookers have really said, President Trump, are you really saying that North Korea has been unthreatening and respectful when it engages in so much of that kind of activity and when it's just backing U.S. enemies in every way it possibly can? So South Koreans have been shaken by this, as has much of the world, and the South Koreans are now working hard to become militarily independent since, as you said in the introduction there, they just don't know if they can trust America. South Korea already has the world's fifth most powerful military. That's a remarkable rank to hold for such a small nation, but they've got the world's fifth most powerful military, and now, partly because of this erratic behavior from the United States, they're building nuclear-powered submarines, and they're even discussing building a nuclear arsenal of, you know, nuclear warheads. So they are preparing to go it alone without the United States, and this is something that the trumpet has been expecting. Biblical prophecy discusses a group of Asian nations that will come together in our modern era. You can read about that in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Revelation, among others. These passages show that Russia will be the lead player in this economic alliance and that China will also be a major player. But the passages also show that less powerful Asian countries, including the Koreas, will also throw their power behind this Russia-China alliance. You can see that particularly in Ezekiel chapter 38. So when we view those prophecies alongside other prophecies about the soon coming end of America's global power, then it becomes clear that the days are really numbered for the U.S.-South Korea alliance. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, he has a booklet all about these prophecies. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. So for anyone who would like to understand what's ahead for South Korea and for all of Asia, I hope you'll go to thetrumpet.com and pick up your free copy of that booklet. Once again, it's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. In his Truth Social post, where he talked about cutting back the military operations, he talked about his great relationship with North Korea. He also talked about South Korea's refusal to help out more with the war with Iran. And what do you make of this criticism that South Korea is ungrateful, isn't giving America the support or the gratitude, the reciprocity that you would expect from this kind of arrangement? I mean, after all, more than 35,000 Americans died to protect South Korea from North Korea. I mean, that is it was some time ago, but that is a pretty major price that America has paid, a pretty impressive sacrifice America made for South Korea. There's the continuing military sacrifice, monetary sacrifice, keeping them open. And okay, from all of that, including the Korean War, there's strategic interest, there's benefits that America derives. I mean, is there a turning away from America that we see in South Korea where they're not willing to give anything back to that relationship?
I think it's a valid point for sure. And South Korea receives an immense amount of its oil through the Strait of Hormuz and you know, from that region. So they have quite an interest in helping the United States, and yet they didn't. And so I think that's valid for sure. At the same time, though, for him to say, I'm going to start to lean toward North Korea instead of South Korea because South Korea didn't send troops down there. Well, guess what? North Korea is directly aiding Iran. So it's valid, but it's also lopsided to call attention to the South's refusal to help while North Korea is directly aiding the enemy.
Yeah, I think it's just an interesting point. It's the same dynamic that I find myself talking about a lot in Europe, where in some ways there are good points on both sides. Like, I feel like when Donald Trump turns to Germany and to European powers and criticizes them and says, well, you're taking all of the benefits from the global stability that America provides. And okay, America, yeah, gets a bunch of benefits from that as well. But America is bearing the vast majority of the costs. And these other countries aren't really bearing the cost. And these other countries are also becoming a hotbed of anti-Americanism. I think that that's right. There's a lot of truth there. At the same time, then, to say South Korea, stand on your own, or even more, Germany, stand on your own, build up your military, that response is then where things get dangerous, where you're turning to a country, turning to a country that is already turning against you, and then trying to empower them militarily. So we see the same dynamic all around the world, and it's leading to America pushing other countries, countries that it can't really trust, to rearm and be able to fight.
I think that's a great point. And I think that this is, you know, it's a high altitude kind of a discussion, very big picture. But since 1945, roughly, the world has been in an era that's often described as the long peace. And it has been extremely expensive for the United States to maintain this network of alliances with Europe through NATO and with South Korea and Japan and other Asian powers as well. It's been expensive, but peace is expensive. And even though we have had to pay exorbitant sums in a lot of ways, NATO in particular has very strategically kept European countries, Germany at the top of the list, sort of militarily neutered, very, very weak. And we've said, it's okay, you can remain militarily weak because we have your back. If you're invaded by Russia or some other aggressor, we will be there. And so it has been to the benefit of all of Europe and all the world to keep Germany weak so that they can't start another World War II or World War I or other conflicts that they instigated even before that. So it's a complex question, and there's not a perfect answer to it by any means, and the U.S. debt can't be ignored. But I think that to really have a clear view of why we've had 7-8 decades of peace now, comparative peace that the world, you know, had never seen before that time, it's a model that we should try to preserve, having these alliances with Europe, these alliances with Asia, not because we're relying on them, but because we're keeping them weak and keeping them from being able to make war, you know, in any kind of meaningful way.
Well, thank you again for that story, Jeremiah. What else do you have for us from Asia?
Yeah, just one other story here about Russia and its war on Ukraine. Hard to believe that this war has now been raging for 4.5 years, but it will hit that 4.5 year anniversary on Monday. And this week, we learned that Russian forces have built or expanded 10 military bases near the borders of both Ukraine and Belarus. These bases are specifically designed to deploy swarms of new jet-powered drones at Ukraine. So the strategy is engineered to overwhelm Ukraine's air defenses and to penetrate those air defenses by sending large numbers of drones simultaneously from several locations. So it's just one more sign that even after 4.5 years, Russian President Vladimir Putin's ambition for conquest, that ambition is unyielding and undiminished.
Tucker Carlson and Hunter Biden, politically related figures. I don't know if we'd quite call them politicians, but two very different figures. They sat down a few weeks ago and talked about the world and had a very surprising view in common. We'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller, to hear what it was.
Yeah, I think this interview, it shocked a lot of people because at one point, Tucker Carlson's not as important as he used to be. But at one point, he was the most widely watched political commentator on television, in the United States at least. So he used to be very influential in American political commentary, and he has a lot of followers. He really gained quite a bit of fame in the United States 6 years ago for some of his interviews exposing Hunter Biden's laptop. Hunter Biden, he dropped this laptop off at a repair shop. It ended up getting picked up by the FBI. And they've chronicled, like, basically 459 different crimes he committed, ranging from business crimes with Eastern European oligarchs to sex crimes, like pressuring employees he worked with into sexual favors, numerous drug crimes, so many crimes that the media had to extensively censor this story before the 2020 presidential election, because we now actually have polls showing that, like, if people would have known about this, Joe Biden probably would not have gotten into office. So that brings us to this month, where Tucker Carlson, after 6 years, he's circled all the way back to his beginnings, sat down with Hunter Biden himself, actually apologized to Hunter for not showing more grace, is the term to use, regarding his drug addiction. So he's no longer criticizing him for committing like 120 different drug offenses, but just saying he should have been more sympathetic to his addictions. And then basically gave Hunter a platform to pivot that he actually never dropped the laptop off at the repair shop. But this is, these were rumors spread by an organization linked to Benjamin Netanyahu. Basically claiming that because of political differences between the Netanyahu administration and his the Democratic Party in the United States at the time, the Israelis wanted to keep the Democrats out of office and spread this as a disinformation campaign against him. Interesting claim in that he never brought this up before. As a matter of fact, before, up until just recently, the Biden family story is that this was a disinformation campaign spread by Vladimir Putin and the Russians. So it's the Russia scandal that the Russians were trying to, like, make up this information. Now, the information's not made up. They've got Hunter Biden's signature on the laptop. They've got, like, cell phone data putting him at the cigar shop next to the laptop. But he's pivoting from Russia made this up to Israel made this up. And that seems to have gotten Tucker Carlson's attention. Tucker Carlson was very against the idea that Russia did this. And he spoke out pretty courageously against the Democratic parties that the Russians were involved in spreading Hunter Biden's crimes. Although he was willing to, like, sit there silently for the most part and listen to this idea that Netanyahu did this. Carlson's gone on record publicly before saying that he thinks Netanyahu's evil and he's very against the Netanyahu administration. So now that Hunter's pivoted from, oh, actually, Russia's responsible for people knowing about my crimes, to Israel's responsible for people knowing about my crimes, he's gotten Tucker Carlson's ear. And I feel like the main reason I want to bring this up, as you mentioned at the beginning, Tucker Carlson's not a politician. Although he said he might run for president in the future. He's never run for political office before. Neither is Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden's related to a politician. So this is a media figure talking to the son of a former Democratic president. So neither of these are politicians. But the idea that someone who made his reputation basically criticizing the Biden crime family is now sitting down with a member of the Biden crime family and agreeing that our real enemy here, Republicans and Democrats, is the Netanyahu administration specifically and the state of Israel more generally, is significant. They had an article in the Jerusalem Post, and its takeaway from this interview is that there was a time, not that long ago, in American policy when attacking the state of Israel was mainly a Democrat talking point. Obama did it, Biden did it. Republicans more emphasized the special relationship that existed between the United States and Israel. This Carlson-Biden interview kind of represents the breaking of that consensus, where attacking Israel is not just a Democratic talking point. It's something that conservatives and leftists can agree on. Now, I looked up some polling statistics before I came in here to just try to get a grasp on how much is this just one media figure like Carlson looking for attention? And how much does this actually represent a shift in Republican policy, like the Jerusalem Post says? And it seems like the most reliable polling data we have shows that the Republican Party is still at least 70% supportive of the state of Israel. It's mostly a demographic divide with older Republicans, baby boomers, still being quite supportive of the state of Israel, and younger Republicans, particularly those over 35, gravitating more towards Carlson. About 54% of Republicans polled said they hold favorable... About 54% of Carlson's own viewers said that even though they like Carlson, they still have favorable opinions of Israel. So I don't think he's speaking for the majority of Republicans by any means. He's speaking for a minority position, but a growing minority position, which is an important trend to us to watch. Mr. Stephen Fleury, he's the host of the Trumpet Daily radio program, did a Trumpet brief on this interview earlier this week, particularly pointing to a prophecy in Isaiah 9, verses 21, about, it says, Manasseh shall devour Ephraim and Ephraim Manasseh. Together they shall be against Judah. So, if you've read Herbert W. Armstrong's The United States and Britain in Prophecy, you know that Ephraim and Manasseh in Bible prophecy are Britain and the United States. And for decades, we've used the term special relationship in American policy primarily to refer to the relationship between the United States and Britain and the United States and Israel. With other nations, we just have a relationship, but with Britain and Israel, we have a special relationship. So this Bible prophecy is about a time where those special relationships start breaking down, where Britain and America are against each other, and the only thing that Britain and America really agree on is they're both against the state of Israel. And so that's not, that doesn't seem to be just a conservative versus liberal thing, but we're now starting to see even a wing of the conservative party opposing the state of Israel. And that's something that's prophesied directly in your Bible, and is really a larger symptom of really both America and Israel, but it seems like right now, especially America, turning away from the biblical values they were founded on. Like I said, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah, these are all three tribes of Israel, all coming from the same culture, the same values. But as they drift more from those values, the unity that used to unite those three nations is dissolving. And I think that's really the biggest takeaway we should take for the fact that why is Tucker Carlson, of all people, sitting down with Hunter Biden, of all people, and even though traditionally they have not agreed on anything, the one thing they seem to agree with is we need to oppose the state of Israel in the Middle East.
It's such a revealing story, and I think it's one that's important to cover on this show, because I don't think you can understand that without the understanding the spiritual dimension behind world events. Like, this has been such a remarkable shift. You don't have to go, and basically before Barack Obama, Israel wasn't that controversial in at least mainstream politics. Like, the Democrats and the Republicans, at the very least, both would say we support Israel. Now, they might have different opinions on, say, the Oslo Accords and things like that, but say, like a Bill Clinton, when he's running for office, he would have to say generally nice things about Israel to get the support of the centrist and the left-wing voters that he's trying to appeal to. This has really changed. We have seen such a remarkable shift. And the crazy thing about a lot of this shift is it was turbocharged by an attack against Jews. Like, if anything, you would have thought the world would have shifted in a radically pro-Israel direction after October 7th. And the evil that Israel has been fighting against is really exposed. Okay, they are fighting for their lives against genocidal maniacs. Maybe at one point I thought, well, there's some good and bad on both sides, or that, you know, they just need to talk it out. And, well, here on October 7th, Israel tries to talk it out. They try to help the Palestinians in Gaza, they pull out of Gaza, they drag their own citizens out of Gaza, they then try to help Gaza develop economically, they say, hey, we're going to make it easier for you to cross the border into Israel so you can have better jobs and more economic opportunities, we really want to help you guys. And then the Palestinians respond by using the easier border crossing to surveil the border, to plan a brutal attack, to go and murder 12, 13,000 Israelis. So yeah, that exposes what Israel is dealing with, and yet the response is to see the world go in a radically unhinged anti-Semitic direction. It defies logic until you understand, well, there's a real spirit world. You know, Jesus Christ was constantly seeing the spiritual reality behind the people he was interacting with. And there's a lot in the Gospels about demons and Satan, and there is that real spirit world that we don't see. But if we're followers of Jesus Christ, we have to acknowledge it's real. And I think when you see stories like this, when you see people changing the way that Tucker Carlson has and the way that America's political system has, it's powerful evidence of this this spiritual broadcast that hates the Jews, that Satan the devil hates the people that God chose for his son to come and be born among.
Yeah. It is definitely a very important story that we'll keep close tabs on. Like I said, right now, I looked at the opinion polls, and I feel like it's still in a case where the majority of Republicans support the state of Israel, do not want the Jews to be annihilated, feel like Israel is the only functioning democracy in the Middle East, and the alliance is still relatively strong. But the shift has started. A shift has started with a sizable minority of, especially those in, like, Tucker Carlson's orbit, actually agreeing more with the Biden family about Israel than they do with Donald Trump. And there's just one other verse, one other prophecy, I guess I can end my segment on. Another one from Hosea 11, verse 12, that says, Ephraim encompasses me about with lies, and Israel with deceit. but Judah yet rules with God and is faithful to the saints. And so really kind of an interesting verse talking about in the end time, ironically, it's going to be the Jews are going to have a better relationship with true Christians than America and Britain are. You'd think that because America and Britain, or at least traditionally, have been Christian nations, that they'd have more in common with true Christians than the Jews would. Although there is definitely this verse, and it's brought out in Mr. Stephen Fleury's trumpet brief from this week, talking about that it seems like in the end there's other prophecies in Amos 7 about even like an end time leader in the United States telling God's prophet, go to Judah, because I don't want to hear your message. And so we definitely see that. We've had high-ranking advisors from the Benjamin Netanyahu administration come visit us here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus and talk about anti-Semitism and other political topics. And so I feel like even here in Edmond, Oklahoma, we've got better contacts with important people in Israel than we do in Britain or America. We haven't had any of Donald Trump's closest advisors, at least not his current batch of closest advisors, want to come talk to us about anything. Though we have with Israel. So I feel like that's also a prophetically significant observation, that it seems like, yeah, there's people in Israel who are more receptive to hearing about what we have to say than even other people in America and Britain in the world, which is just really a fascinating thing to think about.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. What else do you have for us from the English-speaking world?
Yeah, a few other political and social trends. We actually had a former advisor linked to Dr. Anthony Fauci come forward and plead guilty to hiding government information about the COVID pandemic, particularly about the role that Fauci and others played in suppressing the facts that it leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And pushed forward this wet market leak theory when pretty much everyone knew from the beginning that that wasn't true. So that guilty plea doesn't implicate Dr. Fauci directly, but it does cast a spotlight on the scandals that were happening in the U.S. government around the COVID pandemic scandal. Another sad story here about just moral decline in Israelite nations is they had a great-grandmother in Canada, or actually I think just a grandmother in Canada, who was euthanized without her consent. Canada's got this MAID program, you know, it's a government-assisted suicide. As you get older, you can actually, instead of just committing suicide, you can have a doctor help you commit suicide. This is a case where actually I think their primary caregiver had taken them in to get suicide. They'd talked her into it initially. She revoked her consent afterwards. She had second thought. She's like, I don't want to go through with this. And the government went through and did it anyway. Showing that this is really shifting from like government-assisted suicide to just government-assisted murder. I mean, suicide is self-murder, but it's like even murdering someone who does not want to die, which is something that, yeah, generations ago with just a more of a biblical view of where life comes from. Your life is a gift from God, therefore even you can't take it away. Something that as Canada's turned away from this truth, you're just sliding more and more down the slippery slope into like even more blatant sins.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Should Syria be allowed to get nuclear bombs? And that sounds like a bonkers question. The country is literally led by a former Islamic State terrorist. Obviously, they shouldn't be allowed anywhere near any kind of nuclear material. However, President Trump has done a deal that puts them on the path towards a bomb. To hear more about this, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, as if the nuclear talks with Iran and Saudi Arabia aren't enough, we have a deal with Syria now. It was leaked to the media August 10th, technically, that there is a new arrangement, but we got more details of this on August 18th. Some context. So, under the previous Syrian government, Bashar al-Assad, they had a nuclear program running that was very clearly for nuclear weapons. Israel struck its main facility in 2007. Assad wasn't able to do much progress on it since then, but he took some of the uranium that was salvageable and put it in various storage sites. Since he fell, his government fell 2 years ago, there has been some question whether the new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, and his band of former al-Qaeda, even as he mentioned, former ISIS-linked terrorists, would be able to get a hold of that. Israel preempted them and bombed the entrance to one of those main uranium storage sites, not the facility itself, but just the entrance, so they couldn't come in. And they reportedly were going to bomb that site again if Sharaa tried to physically remove the rubble and get a hold of the uranium. And so this is what led up to the deal coming up. President Trump and the administration said, no, wait a minute, nobody has to go to blows. We can get a piece of paper going. We're going to involve the UN, the Atomic Energy Agency there, in this, and we have an agreement that will make everybody happy. We'll just diffuse tensions. Everybody gets what they want. Well, on August 18th, the Director General of the Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, confirmed that they found a few tons of nuclear material just at this one site. And because of the deal, they were able to go in and remove that material from the site. But where is that material going to? Well, it's actually going nowhere. It's staying in Syria and just being handed over to the government. The Syrian foreign minister, Assad al-Shabani, no relation to Bashar Assad, said was with him at that press conference, and he said that this nuclear material, quote, do not pose a risk, end quote, to global security, to nuclear proliferation, and it's going to remain in the Syrian government's hands because Syria has a, quote, sovereign and legal right to enrich uranium. Sovereign and legal right, where have we heard that before? That's exactly the Iranian talking point for their nuclear program over and over and over again. And this Syrian official is using even their same language. And in that press conference, I may add, Grossi said that this uranium could have been used for very, very bad purposes. So he says that it poses a threat. And then the Syrian guy comes right afterwards and says, oh no, it doesn't pose a threat, and we're going to get it anyway. And the UN guy's just sitting there smiling, not saying anything with that. As you mentioned, the current government is a terror government. The movement that Sharaa led that overthrew Bashar Assad, it was al-Qaeda's franchise, essentially, into Syria. And then he swapped back and forth between al-Qaeda and ISIS, and then al-Qaeda again, depending on who was more popular, who could give him more support. But it's essentially a jihadist army made up of foreign fighters that came to Syria to spread Islamism. They're not, many of those fighters aren't even Syrian. Since they've came into power, they've been very graphic, very public examples of his men going after minorities, religious minorities, Christians, Druze. There's been stories of him harboring Palestinian terror groups like Islamic Jihad, one of the groups that helped with that October 7th massacre. And for President Trump to basically not only pave the way for them to get more security over this nuclear material, but now make it a public issue, involve the UN. So if Israel wanted to remove that material or make it unusable, now all of a sudden they're going to have to be going against the UN and the US and public opinion, when this exact scenario was exactly what they were trying to avoid in the first place. As you mentioned earlier, it's another betrayal by America to an American ally on something that should not be controversial, nuclear proliferation. And specifically, it's another jab at Israel, favoring a very unsavory regime over the only functioning democracy in the Middle East.
I guess the improvement is that this nuclear material will be inspected, in theory, by the IAEA, the Atomic Energy Agency. They will be monitoring it. It's not weapons grade, so it is moving in that direction. But again, I understand it's not weapons grade. So what are the kind of the risks, or what are the steps to go from here to a nuclear bomb? And okay, we set this up in terms of this is a terrorist state that has nuclear precursor material. And I think that's something that hasn't been warned about enough. Just to be clear, nobody is giving Syria permission to develop the bomb. This does make it a lot easier for them to move in that direction, though. So what is involved? What would be involved in them going in that direction?
Well, Syria, of course, just came out of a very devastating civil war. Their infrastructure is in tatters. Not every patch of the country is under control of the central government. It's not like if they just wanted to sit down and think, we're going to develop a nuclear bomb tomorrow, they wouldn't have the technical capability or money to even get anywhere near that. This basically legitimizes the next steps to going moving in that direction. I don't think it'd be that strange for a country in Syria's position to want to get nuclear power for civilian use. It would be a cheap, really productive energy source that a country in Syria's state would need. But
I mean, nuclear power's got a lot of advantages. Cheapness generally isn't one of them, though.
Well, I mean, once you get it going, then you don't have to like worry about, say, trade supply lines or continual contracts with foreign buyers. It would be a never-ending domestic supply of energy. But you need that infrastructure to also produce a nuclear bomb. Syria doesn't have that infrastructure, and now it's being basically given international permission to develop that infrastructure. Yes, as you mentioned, the International Atomic Energy Agency will be in cooperation with Syria, and the indications are that they'll be putting all their safeguards into monitoring this program. They've been doing the exact same thing with Iran and their nuclear program all this time, and we've seen how much Iran has been able to not only outwit them in many examples in progressing towards a nuclear bomb, but also use that those dealings with the energy agency to show, well, look, we're maintaining all our obligations. There's nothing to worry. In a sense, it almost provides them a bit of a smokescreen going in that direction. And again, nobody is arguing that nuclear breakout time for Syria is imminent. It's even if they go completely ahead with this project, it won't be for some time. But it is still the step in this direction that they probably wouldn't be able to get otherwise, that stops Israel, which is the only country really that wants to stand in the way of this, from being able to do anything about it. And it's all being done with the encouragement of the United States.
Now, we're watching this story because the Bible has a lot to say about nuclear weapons. And Jesus Christ himself talked about a time where you'd have a war that if it wasn't stopped, well, mankind would wipe himself out. Now, that kind of destructive power at the time of the Roman Empire is impossible humanly to even imagine. But he was prophesying of a time when mankind would have weapons like these nuclear weapons. So what does the Bible have to tell us about these kind of destructive forces?
Well, the prophecy you're referencing is in Matthew 24, verses 21 to 22. The last major prophecy he gave before he was crucified. And he said of all the world's problems, it would be leading to verses 21 and 22. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. The Moffat translation reads that as not a soul be saved alive. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And basically from the beginning of his geopolitical ministry, when he started getting his message from around the world, Herbert W. Armstrong said that this has everything to do with the development of nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction. And Mr. Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has continued that prediction. His entire book called Nuclear Armageddon is at the door that focuses on North Korea and Iran, two countries we've touched on in this program. But the point he makes in that book is the Bible is very specific on who's going to start World War III and names a few countries. But even countries not directly related to this prophecy, but that are still unstable, that are still around the world getting nuclear weapons, doing nuclear experimentation, that is still a sign of the troubling times we're living in. When Mr. Armstrong started talking about this prophecy, it was just the United States that had used them in Japan, and Russia and the United Kingdom had caught up a little bit forward. Now we're talking about countries as small and unstable as Syria getting potentially these weapons. Even if you don't know a thing about Bible prophecy, you should still be concerned about how quickly and dangerously nuclear proliferation has expanded. And again, Mr. Fleury expands on this theme much more in his booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. What else do you have for us from the Middle East region?
Well, on August 19th, the United Arab Emirates has announced they are halting all trade and all financial transactions otherwise with Iran. The UAE was the biggest hit Middle Eastern country by Iran in the war's active fighting, even more so than Israel. They've been cooperating with Israel quite a bit, and a lot of analysts interpret Iran's attacks as punishment for that. But the Emirates has also let Dubai and some of the other financial centers, they've let Iran do some shady business dealings there anyway. That stopped. That comes in conjunction of the United States pressuring its allies to stop doing more of these dealings. But I think it's a lot more than just external pressure motivating this. I think the Emirates has seen that they can't have their cake and eat it too, that they're going to have to pick a side in the Middle East, and it's not on Iran's side. Also tied in with that, this is technically last week, but we reported on it this week. On August 13th, Saudi Arabia announced a new maritime coalition to patrol the Red Sea. It's going to include countries like Pakistan, Bahrain, Qatar, to essentially, without naming them, stop the Houthis, Iran's proxy group in Yemen, from attacking Red Sea shipping and bringing Red Sea trade to a halt. So again, we're seeing a lot more of these Muslim countries decide we're not going to be on Iran's side and take more drastic measures against Iran. And one last story, this technically happened last month, but it was only translated and reported in English on August 20th with memory. Russia has signed a memorandum with the Palestinian Authority to help the Palestinians protect what they call Palestinian historical heritage from Israel and trying to blot out Palestinian history, which is anybody with a basic education on how the world works would know that that's bonkers. It's the Palestinians trying to cleanse Jewish history out of the Holy Land. There are a lot of people claiming that Jesus was a Palestinian, even when the name Palestine didn't exist for another 100 years. After that, Russia is apparently going to try and send technical equipment, even drones, into the Palestinian Authority, and according to Memory's report, are even trying to come up with creative ways to slip by Israeli border guards, etc. I think this goes to show, for those people that support the Palestinians are the real controllers of the land, all this Jewish history and whatever, that's made up. I mean, this is who you're making company with. You're making company with one of the most egregious abusers of human rights and enemies of Western civilization in the world. Andrew had an article months back called Why Anti-Semitism is Anti-Western. If you need any more proof about why that is the case, when you're looking at the international campaign by these horrible actors to blot out basic history and basic archaeology that until recently was accepted as just being valid as the sky being blue, this is that proof.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. We might keep you around just in case you want to weigh in, because a lot of the European stories also revolve around the Middle East. The Pope and the Catholic Church has had a very busy week, especially when it comes to Israel. On Sunday, Pope Leo accused Israel of persecuting Christians in the West Bank, and it really raised the profile of a story that had kind of been doing the rounds with the Tucker Carlsons of this world, like Andrew was talking about. But, I mean, Tucker Carlson has a pretty big platform. The Pope has an even bigger one. He said, "I renew my appeal for an end to the ongoing violence against the Palestinian civilian population in the West Bank." And it's carefully worded, but it amplifies a narrative that Catholic readers have been expressing for weeks. And that is that Israel is persecuting Christians in the West Bank. And I think, understandably, this narrative does get a lot of traction. We do know that there's a lot of Christians in the Middle East that are persecuted, and that the major powers of this world don't show much interest in doing anything about it. We'll let Muslims pour into our countries, but if Muslim countries or any Middle Eastern country persecutes Christians, we don't do anything about it. So when you have a story like this, it gains a lot of traction. And there's a couple of examples, a couple of areas that have gained particular attention. Tiber is one near Ramallah. It's the last remaining fully Christian town in this West Bank area. And Israeli settlers there are accused of intimidating local Palestinians. The state of Israel is responding, the Israeli Defense Force. They've closed the area. They've declared it a closed military town. They've blocked the movement of Israelis while leaving Palestinians free to come and go. And they've said, well, this is a measure to try and get control of the situation and stop any settler violence or settler intimidation against local Palestinians. Similar story in Kusra, further north, where you've had extremist settlers accused of targeting at least two families there. The IDF has entered the area to remove the settlers and to protect Palestinians. But several Catholic leaders have drawn attention to these areas, particularly Tiber. And generally, they will blame Israel as a whole for this rather than a minority of settlers. So a local priest in Tiber, he said on August 10th that the town was a victim of, quote, a deliberate strategy of harassment designed to create a climate of fear and pressure Palestinian families into leaving their land. James Curry, he's the lead bishop for the Holy Land for the Catholic Bishops Conference of England and Wales. He gave put out a statement where he was implying that Israel was basically being disingenuous with closing access of the town to the town. It wasn't about protecting Palestinians. He said this ban will lead to a vital loss of income from tourism and pilgrimage, and thereby international scrutiny on the situation. So actually, this is about keeping out journalists, not about protecting Palestinians. And then Cardinal Pizzaballa, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, he visited Tiber the day before the Pope's comments, and he gave a speech where he was urging the residents to confront evil. Now, if you have Israeli settlers attacking Christian Palestinians, that is certainly something to be condemned. But it is worth approaching this with a degree of skepticism and caution. Because if you're really, really into the minutiae of news, I guess, and have paid really close attention to news from this region, Tiber will be familiar because of a story that came out last summer and last spring. Tiber was the location where supposedly Israeli settlers went in there and set one of the oldest churches in the region on fire. It caused a major firestorm in the news, no pun intended, and a lot of these same people that we're seeing talk about Tiber now, they had a lot of things to say then. You had the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem, Theophilus III. He visited Tiber, and he said radical Israelis from nearby settlements intentionally set fire near the town cemetery and the Church of St. George. He said as well, this is not only a violation of property, but a targeted attack under a community that has long been a symbol of coexistence and peace. Pizzaballa stood by his side in Tiber while he gave that speech. And the patriarch and the heads of the churches in Jerusalem, all of these different individuals, they put out a joint statement and they said settler violence was responsible for this fire, and it was both facilitated and enabled by state policies. So it's not just, so settlers started the fire, and it's not just settlers that are guilty. This is something that the state of Israel stands behind. It wasn't until a fair bit later that we got the truth. It took some time for it to come out, but we got videos. And if you started to look closely at the videos, I think the initial ones we saw were quite blurry. We got some better detail. And instead of Israeli settlers running to spread the fires, we saw Israeli settlers running with fire extinguishers in their hands to try and put it out. The settlers weren't burning the church. They were trying to save it. We got more details, and we found that actually the Palestinian Arabs in the area had been starting fires. They'd been trying to burn fields so that the Israeli settlers couldn't graze their livestock there. So this wasn't about Israeli settlers trying to intimidate Palestinians. It was the other way around. It was the Palestinians trying to intimidate and starve out the Israeli settlers. The whole story was back to front. And the same officials that are out there criticizing Tiber were promoting an entirely false narrative. And the church was not burned. The cemetery was not burned. They're all still there. Now, I don't claim to know exactly what's going on in Tiber this time, but given that we've seen people cry wolf about the situation before, we shouldn't rush to judgment this time. I mean, Mihailo, you watched this region closely. Did you have any other observations on this story?
I need to do a little more looking at the current situation, but I'll say this much, little add to the context of the previous story. You saw in the media then everyone was saying, look, they set fire to a church. Like, they set fire, like, they're going after places of worship. That church was an archaeological site from the Byzantine times that has been in ruins for centuries. You look at the picture and there's more grass growing in the territory than there is actual anything touched by man's hand. So you see manipulation of the narrative even just in the setting. And then afterwards, that was when that famous story broke out of Israel, a tank striking the only Catholic church in Gaza. And at least according to one of the Catholic Church's official publications, who spoke with some of Pete Zabala's lieutenants, they claimed in that publication that Israel intentionally bombed the Catholic Church in Gaza because Pete Zabala made a stopover in Tiber afterwards to bring up publicity. In other words, that Israel was intentionally going out of its way to massacre Catholics out of spite. That is, I mean, sometimes people talk about, oh, look at the blood libel they're throwing on Israel, whatever, and you're thinking, okay, maybe that's a little bit of an extreme comparison. In this case, that is exactly what is going on, at least before, that they were accusing Israel of murdering Christians through manipulation and gross distortion of territories, basically implying that Israel is going out of its way to kill Christians. And I would not be surprised if with this current story, they try to do some more gross manipulation to imply the same thing. I mean, they already are, but even more so extrapolating it.
And it's, you know, it's bishops, it's religious leaders. And we're used to politicians lying to us. We're used to the media lying to us. I mean, I guess around religious figures in some circles, there's a certain cynicism these days. Catholic bishops or Catholic priests in particular have been caught up in enough scandals that I guess they've lost a lot of the sheen that they once had in public imagination. But still, you know, we are seeing bishops, people who claim to teach the truth, spinning new stories the way that we would expect politicians to, bringing this kind of twisted narrative. We're also seeing it from Catholic media. Crux, they're a prominent Catholic news outlet. And if you look at their section, the church in the Middle East, it's filled with all these stories about Israel targeting Christians and none of the actual stories about other countries where you have more systemic problems. So their headlines, Israel's Christians rely on faith and allies as they fear rising harassment. Israeli settlers creating climate of fear for West Bank Christians. Disheartening, attacks against Christians nearly double in Israel territories, says report. Lebanese Christians on the edge of Israel's occupation live with fear and rising tension. This is the type of narrative that we expect of the Tucker Carlsons of this world. And the Catholic Church is pushing the same narrative. And you have genuine attacks against Christians, systemic attacks against Christians all across the Middle East. One of the biggest was an incident in July where you had basically a lynch mob attacking a Coptic church in Egypt. And it was only halted when the police arrived and arrested the Christians that were being attacked. So you've got... So you've got the genuine persecution being ignored. And if you were to just look at their Church in the Middle East section, you would conclude that the biggest threat to Christians in the Middle East was the state of Israel. When instead, this is one of the few places in the Middle East where you've not seen a radical reduction in the number of Christians. And the Pope, this is getting involved in spreading this same propaganda. All of these articles, even things like the Pope's statement, they present a very one-sided account of the news. They often describe Israel's response, and then they completely omit what it was in response to. The Palestinians' attacks and things like that that triggers it. They'll give statistics about settler attacks on Palestinians. You know, these are how many Palestinians have been caught up in settler attacks or even killed. And again, I think it's worth being skeptical and not taking those reports at face value. But even then, they omit, they don't mention the far larger number of Palestinian attacks against settlers. These are how many settlers have been killed. And you need to understand what is happening to the settlers to see the full picture. That they're under attack, that they're dying, that they're fearful for their lives. And what you see with this is the most powerful people in the Catholic Church laying the foundation for a call for Europe to return to the Middle East to defend the region's Christians, and not just the Christians that genuinely are persecuted across the Muslim Middle East, but to get in there and protect them from Jews. And you look at even the recent history of the Catholic Church's statements on the state of Israel, it's very clear they believe Jerusalem is theirs and that Jerusalem should be an international city, that the Jews shouldn't be in control of Christian sites. Pizzaballa has condemned, quote, Christian Zionism, as he called it, as heresy. The Catholic Church is working to unite Christians against Jews. And another story from the Middle East shows they're involved in politics to do this. So the leader of Lebanon was in Rome this week. Actually, he's still in Rome. He was meeting with the Pope. I think he's meeting with Giorgia Meloni, the Italian leader, today. But Pope Leo XIV was signaling his support for Joseph Arnu, the Lebanese president, and Lebanon. He was condemning Israel for continuing his attacks on the Lebanese territory. He condemned Israel for refusing to withdraw from Lebanese territory. He had nothing to say about Lebanon not disarming Hezbollah and failing to live up to what it has agreed. Again, it's this one-sided narrative. The Arnu, he also met with Cardinal Pietro Parolin, basically the Vatican's foreign minister or secretary of state, you could say. And so they're building concrete ties with Lebanon. If you want to be more involved in the Middle East, and if you want to get involved in Jerusalem, well, having ties, having links to Lebanon is an important stage, an important step to get involved there. If you go back to our May-June issue of this year, the Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has just a really powerful article, Reviving the Dark Ages, that gets to the core of this story. Why is the Catholic Church doing this? Why are we getting back to crusading-type language? I mean, this is the exact reason for the Crusades. Christians are being persecuted. We've got to go in and protect them. I think, well, that was true during the Crusades. Christians were being persecuted. But you're seeing a return to this kind of language. And as this article talks about, well, you know, this type of time period where the Crusades were going on, there was a lot of religious persecution. It was a dark age. Well, now we're returning to these kind of dark ages. The Bible prophesies this. The Bible talks about this rising power in Europe. And the Bible says it looks good. It speaks like a lamb, and I think you look at what is going to be coming in Europe over the next few years or next few months, it is going to look good compared to wokeism and socialism and radical Islam, and there's going to be a lot of people cheering it. It's going to look like a lamb. It's going to look harmless, and it's going to look like the Church of Jesus Christ, and it will look like we're getting back to God and to Jesus and the Bible. But those same scriptures in Revelation also say it speaks like the dragon. And you see that. If you pay attention to what a lot of these popes are saying, what the lies that are coming out from bishops, they look righteous. And they speak like the dragon. That is what is rising up here. And that is going to be stirring Europe to get more involved in the Middle East. So you can read more in that article, Reviving the Dark Ages. It's a really important story to watch and to understand. Well, as part of Europe getting ready to be involved in the Middle East, we saw this week Germany saying they've got the highest number of personnel in their military since the rough aftermath of when they abolished conscription in 2011. Obviously, after they abolished conscription, it took a few years for it to dip down. Now things are coming back up again. Deutsche Welle talked about how in a nation beset by bad economic news, they said it's a comparatively rare success story. And they're right. The Bundeswehr, it's 186,700 troops as of July 31st. It met its minimum target. It means they're on course to meet their target of having 260,000 troops by the mid-2030s. What I think is interesting about this is there was a lot of discussion in Germany about how hard it would be to boost their militaries to reach this minimum, to reach their minimum targets each year. And maybe they will have some more struggles down the line, I don't know. But the fact that they've managed to hit that is pretty remarkable. It shows that they're able to get people to turn out and to build, to join up with their military. Another way that they're building up their military is they've opened up another drone research center, drone security technology center in Saxony-Anhalt. It comes just a couple of weeks after Germany found an explosive-carrying drone near one of Europe's most important cargo air terminals. So they're looking more about into modern warfare. We're also seeing Germans frustrated with their leaders. We're getting more and more pulled along these lines. We got some more of those this week. An August 14th poll found that the disapproval rating of Friedrich Merz hit 78%, making him one of the most unpopular chancellors since 1949, you know, since Germany's been having post-war chancellors. Only 21% said they still supported his coalition alliance. 84% of Germans said they thought political parties were indifferent to their issues. 56% believes no single party can fix Germany. They're fed up not just with Merz, but with parties. And we're watching for Europe to rise that is led by a king of fierce countenance, as the Bible talks about. So keep watching for the rise of this Germany. Well, that is about all that we have time for. If you'd like to know more, I mentioned Mr. Flurry's article on the Dark Ages. But while we're talking about Europe, we also have our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that's got a lot more to show both from history and from what the Bible says about what is rising up in Europe. It's a great place to go to understand Europe's European news, the role of the Catholic Church in the world, what the Bible says about it. You can get that and a whole host of other material, other books and booklets on our website, thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. Thank you to all of our guests that we've had on the show. If you have any questions and comments, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We would love to hear from you. We will be back next week on Wednesday with our regular show. Until then, keep watching your world.